In the morning, Harry marked the sites for the prospect bores with cairns of stone, and Ralph realized how cunningly he was quartering the extended line of the reef to pick it up again at depth. By noon he had finished, and as they upsaddled, Ralph made a swift calculation and realized it would be another 2 days before Kathy's twin sisters could arrive at the base camp from Kami Mission. "Seeing that we've come so far, we should make a sweep out towards the east before turning back. God knows what we could find. More gold, diamonds?" And when Harry hesitated, "Mr. Rhodes will have gone on to Bulawayo already. He'll be holding court there for the next month at least. He won't even miss you." Harry thought for a moment, then grinned like a schoolboy about to bunk his classes to raid the orchard. "Let's go," he said. They rode slowly, and at each river course they dismounted to pan the gravel from the bottom of the stagnant green pools. Wherever the bedrock outcropped above the overburden of earth, they broke off samples. They searched out the burrows of ant bear and porcupine, and the nests of the swarming white termites, to find what grains and chippings they had brought up from the depth. On the third day, Harry said, "Oh, we've picked up a dozen likely shows of colour. I particularly like those crystals of beryllium. They are a good pointer to emerald deposits." Harry's enthusiasm had increased with each mile ridden. But now they had reached the end of the outward leg of their eastward sweep, and even Ralph realized that it was time to turn back. They had been out 5 days from the base camp. They had exhausted their coffee and sugar and meal, and Kathy would be anxious by now. They took one last look at the country that they must leave unexplored for the time being.
"God, it's beautiful," Harry murmured. "I've never seen a more magnificent land. What is the name of that range of hills?"
"That's the southern end of the Metopus."
"I've heard Mr. Rhodes speak of them. Aren't they the sacred hills of the Matabele?"
Ralph nodded. "If I believed in witchcraft..." He broke off and chuckled with embarrassment.
"There is something about those hills."
There was the first rosy flush of the sunset in the western sky, and it turned the smooth, polished rock of those distant, brooding hills to pink marble, while their crests were garlanded with fragile twists of cloud, coloured by the softly slanting rays to ivory and ashes.
"There's a secret cave hidden in there, where a witch who presided over the tribes used to live. My father took in a commando and destroyed her at the beginning of the war against Lurban Gula."
"I have heard the story. It is one of the legends already."
"Well, it's true. They say..."
Ralph broke off and studied the tall and turreted range of rock with a thoughtful expression.
"Those are not clouds, Harry," he said at last. "That's smoke. Yet there are no kraals in the Metopus. It could be a bushfire, but I don't think so. It's not on a broad front."
"Then where is the smoke coming from?"
"That is what we're going to find out," Ralph replied.
And before Harry could protest, he had started his horse and was cantering across the plains of pale winter grass towards the high rampart of bare granite that blocked off the horizon. A Matabele warrior sat aloof from the men who swarmed about the earthen kilns. He sat in the meagre shade of a twisted cripplewood tree. He was lean, so that the rack of his ribs showed through the covering of elastic muscle under his cloak. His skin was burned by the sun to the deep midnight black of carved ebony, and it was glossed with health, like the coat of a race-trained thoroughbred, blemished only by the old healed gunshot wounds on his chest and back. He wore a simple kilt and cloak of tanned leather, no feathers nor war rattles, no regimentals of fur nor plumes of marabou stalk upon his bared head. He was unarmed, for the white men had made roaring bonfires of the long rawhide shields and carried away the broad silver assegais by the wagon load. They had confiscated also the Martini Henry rifles with which the company had paid King Lurban Gula for the concession to all the mineral wealth beneath this land. On his head the warrior wore the headring of the Induna. It was of gum and clay, woven permanently into his own hair, and black and hard as iron.
This badge of rank announced to the world that he had once been a counsellor of Lobengula, the last king of the Matabele. The simple ring declared his royal bloodline, the Zanzi blood of the Kumalo tribe, running back pure and unbroken to old Zululand, 1,000 miles and more away in the south. Mzilikazi had been this man's grandfather. Mzilikazi, who had defied the tyrant Chaka and led his people away towards the north. Mzilikazi, the little chief who had slaughtered 1 million souls on that terrible northward march, and in the process had become a mighty emperor, as powerful and cruel as Chaka had ever been. Mzilikazi, his grandfather, who had finally brought his nation to this rich and beautiful land, who had been the first to enter these magical hills and to listen to the myriad weird voices of the Amlimo, the Chosen One, the witch and oracle of the Matopos. Lobengula, son of Mzilikazi, who ruled the Matabele after the old king's death, had been the young man's blood uncle. It was Lobengula who had granted him the honours of the Induna's head ring and appointed him commander of one of the elite fighting impis. But now Lobengula was dead, and the young Induna's impi had been blown to nothing by the Maxim guns on the bank of the Shangani River. And the same Maxim guns had branded him with those deeply dimpled cicatrices upon his trunk. His name was Batsu, which means the axe. But more often now, men spoke of him as the wanderer. He had sat beneath the cripplewood tree all that day, watching the ironsmiths perform their rites. For the birth of iron was a mystery to all but these adepts. The smiths were not Matabele, but were members of an older tribe, an ancient people whose origins were somehow interwoven with those haunted and ruined stone walls of Great Zimbabwe. Although the new white masters and their queen beyond the seas had decreed that the Matabele no longer own Amaholi, slaves, yet these Rozwi ironsmiths were still the dogs of the Matabele, still performed their art at the behest of their warlike masters. The 10 oldest and wisest of the Rozwi smiths had selected the ore from the quarry, deliberating over each fragment like vain women choosing ceramic beads from the trader's stock. They had judged the iron ore for colour and weight, for the perfection of the metal it contained, and for its purity from foreign matter. And then they had broken up the ore upon the rock anvils until each lump was the perfect size. While they worked with care and total preoccupation, some of their apprentices were cutting and burning the tree trunks in the charcoal pits, controlling the combustion with layers of earth, and finally quenching it with clay pots of water. Meanwhile, yet another party of apprentices made the long journey to the limestone quarries and returned with the crushed catalyst in leather bags slung upon the backs of the baggage bullocks. When the master smiths had grudgingly approved the quality of charcoal and limestone, then the building of the rows of clay kilns could begin. Each kiln was shaped like the torso of a heavily pregnant woman, like a fat domed belly in which the layers of iron ore and charcoal and limestone would be packed. At the lower end of the kiln was the crotch, guarded by symbolically truncated clay thighs, between which was the narrow opening into which would be introduced the buckhorn nozzle of the leather bellows. When all was ready, the head smith chopped the head off the sacrificial rooster and passed down the line of kilns, sprinkling them with hot blood, while he chanted the first of the ancient incantations to the spirit of iron. Batsu watched with fascination, and a prickle of superstitious awe on his skin, as fire was introduced through the vaginal openings of the kilns, the magical moment of impregnation which was greeted with a joyous cry by the assembled smiths. Then the young apprentices pumped the leather bellows in a kind of religious ecstasy, singing the hymns which ensured the success of the smelting and set the rhythm for the work on the bellows. When each fell back exhausted, there was another to take his place and keep the steady blast of air driving deeply into the kiln. A faint haze of smoke hung over the workings, like sea fret on a still summer's day. It rose to eddy slowly around the tall, bald peaks of the hills. Now, at last, it was time to draw the smelting. And as the head smith freed the clay plug from the first kiln,
A joyous shout of thanksgiving went up from the assembly at the bright glowing rush of the molten metal from the womb of the furnace. Butzo found himself trembling with excitement and wonder, as he had when his first son had been born in one of the caves in these selfsame hills. "The birth of the blades," he whispered aloud, and in his imagination he could already hear the dinning of the hammers as they beat out the metal and the sizzling hiss of the quenching that would set the temper of the edge and point of the broad stabbing spears. A touch on his shoulder startled him from his reverie, and he glanced up at the woman who stood over him, and then he smiled. She wore the leather skirt, decorated with beads, of the married woman, but there were no bangles nor bracelets on her smooth young limbs. Her body was straight and hard, her naked breasts symmetrical and perfectly proportioned. Although she had already suckled a fine son, they were not marred by stretch marks. Her belly was concave as a greyhound's, while the skin was smooth and drummed tight. Her neck was long and graceful, her nose straight and narrow, her eyes slanted above the Egyptian arches of her cheekbones. Her features were those of a statuette from the tomb of some long-dead pharaoh. "Tanasi," said Batsu, "another 1,000 blades." Then he saw her expression and broke off. "What is it?" he asked with quick concern. "Riders," she said, "2 of them, white men coming from the southern forests and coming swiftly." Batsu rose in a single movement, quick as a leopard, alarmed by the approach of the hunters. Only now his full height and the breadth of his shoulders was evident, for he towered a full head over the ironsmiths about him. He lifted the buckhorn whistle that hung on a thong about his neck and blew a single sharp blast. Immediately all the scurry and bustle amongst the kilns ceased, and the master smith hurried to him.